From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. 50 years ago this week, in the early summer of 1963, the civil rights movement was in full swing. On June 11th, in his famous civil rights address, President John F. Kennedy told the nation that he would protect the rights of all who wished to be free. Just hours later, Medgar Evers, 37 years old, father of three, the first Mississippi field secretary for the NAACP, civil rights hero, was shot dead in the driveway of his Jackson home. This hour on Point, the story and legacy of Medgar Evers. You can join us on air or online where this conversation never ends. Can you picture this country on that night? Do you remember it? What's the legacy of Medgar Evers? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. We will hear in this hour from a Medgar Evers biographer, from a civil rights movement colleague of Medgar Evers, and from former governor of Mississippi, Haley Barbour. But first, let's go back to that night. Now, the assassination was actually on June 12th, not long after midnight, but on the evening of June 11th, just hours before Medgar Evers' assassination, President John F. Kennedy delivered his famous civil rights address from the Oval Office in Washington. Here's a bit of that.
If an American, because his skin is dark, cannot eat lunch in a restaurant open to the public, if he cannot send his children to the best public school available, if he cannot vote for the public officials who represent him, if, in short, he cannot enjoy the full and free life which all of us want, then who among us would be content to have the color of his skin changed and stand in his place? Who among us would then be content with the counsels of patience and delay?
Within hours, Medgar Evers, who was working on exactly that civil rights effort in Mississippi, would be dead. Here is the June 1963 news bulletin from NBC News. Details of Medgar Evers' murder beginning to emerge.
15 minutes past midnight, Evers got out of his car beside his home in a Negro residential area. In a vacant lot about 40 yards away, a sniper fired a single shot from a high-powered rifle at Evers' silhouette.
And, of course, that was the night of the death of Medgar Evers. He had been incredibly active in Mississippi. Here's a recording from the previous month, May 1963, just a few weeks before his death, telling activists that civil rights protests would not stop until segregation in Jackson, Mississippi was gone.
This demonstration will continue. We will have a mass meeting tonight, and after the mass meeting, we will be demonstrating even further on tomorrow. So then this will only give us an impetus to move ahead rather than to slow down. We intend to completely eradicate Jim Crow here in Jackson, Mississippi.
The voice of a brave Medgar Evers in May 1963, the month before his assassination, in the carport of his home in Jackson. With us today from Mississippi State University is Michael Vincent Williams, author of the biography Medgar Evers, Mississippi Martyr. He's a professor of history and African American studies at Mississippi State. Michael Vincent Williams, welcome to On Point. Thanks for being here.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
And with us from Kingston, Rhode Island is Reverend Dr. Bernard Lafayette Jr., longtime civil rights activist and co-founder in 1960 of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. He's a visiting scholar at the University of Rhode Island, helped found the university's Center for Nonviolence and Peace Studies. He knew and worked with Medgar Evers in Mississippi in those days. Reverend Dr. Bernard Lafayette, Jr., welcome to On Point. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
There's
glad
a lot
to be here.
We're very happy to have you. What are you thinking on this 50th anniversary coming up in just the middle of this week, day after tomorrow, Dr. Lafayette? About this man who you knew so long ago. Now the airport in Jackson is named after him, and big avenues and boulevards named after him. His widow gave the prayer at President Barack Obama's second inauguration. Would he be dismayed at the progress that's been made, or dismayed at the progress that hasn't been made? What do you think?
Well, I think that, first of all, Medgar Evers was determined to bring about changes, and he did succeed in doing that, even in his death. We realize that certain conditions do not exist now, and that is that people have access to public accommodations, and in many cases, schools that were desegregated are actually you know, have overcome that particular problem. We have not been able to achieve all of the goals that we were set forth in that period of time, but we can say that we're better off than we were before, but we still have, you know, a bit ways to go with that. And like Medgar Evers, I, too, wish we had made more progress by now. And I think that what we have to have now is more understanding of what we did not achieve rather than what we achieved. And once we make that assessment, then we can move forward to what we still have yet to achieve.
Do you think, I mean, you knew Medgar Evers in those days. Was he aware of the severity of the threat to him and others, to his own life?
Absolutely. But he stood as a person of courage. I remember one night that there was a tenant farmer, for example, whose young daughter was actually sent to the house of the landlord, the master, because they were on a tenant farm situation.
Mm-hmm.
And he was tired of it, and he didn't want his daughter to be exposed to, you know, this injustice that was occurring. And he decided that he was either going to take some action against the landlord or he was going to move. Medgar Evers helped him to move late at night in an old truck with an old hat on. Medgar Evers, in disguise, helped him, this tenant farmer, to move off that property and get on public transportation headed north. I stayed in the office all night that night because if anything had occurred, Medgar would have been able to have some backup. Okay?
Yes.
And he also helped to provide the office for the Freedom Riders who came in 1961. He was the person that gave us that kind of support. And the NAACP lawyer, you know, Jack was there. And he also helped to organize a mass meeting for Martin Luther King there at the Masonic Temple.
It was right.
So Medgar was involved in every aspect of the struggle.
Michael Vincent
was aware of the danger.
Michael Vincent Williams, take us back to that time. Medgar Evers helped pull aside the cotton curtain that had kept a lot of the violence from the eyes of the nation. But what? Just remind us of what it was to be in Mississippi and be standing up for civil rights in 1960, 61, 62, 63, the year of his death, Michael.
Well, yeah, I mean, at that particular point, in terms of Medgar Evers' responsibility as field secretary, his job was, in fact, to document all instances of brutality. As field secretary, he was also responsible for organizing NAACP chapters, reporting to the national office, any kinds of abuses, going and investigating those abuses, and then kind of sending that information out so that the nation really could understand what was going on. In terms of what the environment is like, if you were an individual who was going to stand against the status quo, then oftentimes you understood that that could possibly mean your death or beatings, to say the least. But he was definitely an individual who understood that and work to overcome those kinds of issues.
He had seen racial violence, you write in your biography, ever since he was a child. He was absolutely no stranger to it.
Exactly. Coming up, there was a family friend when he was a child that was actually lynched in Decatur. And so he wondered in terms of how did this continue to happen. And to understand that these things could happen to you simply because of the color of your skin was something that always bothered him. You have to also understand, too, that he came from a family that touted racial pride. His father, James Evers, was very, very much adamant in terms of establishing his manhood and demonstrating that. And so as a child, he grew up with those kinds of examples. His mother as well was a person who taught the children that they were just as good as anybody else and that they had a responsibility to the larger community. And so he grew up with that kind of foundation of independence, but also a kind of profound responsibility for the larger community.
Was he nationally known because of his work with the Freedom Riders before his assassination, or did that only happen, that national profile happen after he was killed, Michael?
Well, no, he had some national exposure before his assassination because keep in mind that Evers also traveled across the country. He did West Coast tours in the early 1960s as well, talking about the issues and problems that were going on in Mississippi. Also, he went to Montgomery. During the height of the Montgomery bus boycott, met with Martin Luther King Jr., had instances in which he was with SCLC. And so he had some national exposure. But what happened is, particularly after May 20th, when he gives his televised address, he really kind of takes on a little bit more of a national recognition of what's going on. But people know exactly who he is.
This is a televised address on WBLT out of Jackson, Mississippi, and a very, very unusual for a black man to be given that setting in those years, Michael.
Exactly. But this is something that Evers had been pushing prior to that in terms of getting television access to give the African-American side of the story of what was going on in Mississippi going all the way back to 1957 with the Little Rock crisis that was going on, even though he hadn't got that television exposure. When May 20th happened, he's given that as a rejoinder to Mayor Allen Thompson's earlier address.
We'll come back and look at the circumstances leading to his death and what happened after. Michael Vincent Williams, please stand by, at Mississippi State University, biographer of Medgar Evers. And Reverend Dr. Bernard Lafayette Jr. in Kingston, Rhode Island. Here's Phil Ox with Too Many Martyrs, written after the assassination of Evers. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
And they laid him in his grave while the bugle sounded clear. Laid him in his grave when the victory was near. While we waited for the future, for freedom through the land, the country gained a killer and the country lost a man. Too many martyrs and too many dead. Too many lies, too many empty words were said. Too many times for too many angry men. Oh, let it never be again. Oh, let it never be again.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about slain civil rights hero Medgar Evers, 50 years after his assassination in Mississippi, looking at his story, his legacy, with Michael Vincent Williams, biographer of Medgar Evers. Mississippi Martyr is the book, Medgar Evers. And Reverend Dr. Bernard Lafayette Jr., one of the founders of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, knew Medgar Evers back in the day in Mississippi and beyond. Haley Barber, former governor of Mississippi, will join us in a few minutes to give us a perspective from the white community on those days, what Medgar Evers meant, his death meant, and the changes since then. Here was not long before his death in Mississippi. NBC News Archive here.
We'll be demonstrating here until freedom comes to Negroes here in Jackson, Mississippi.
Speaking there at a rally against the White Citizens Council, a white supremacist group in Jackson, Mississippi, one member of which, Byron De La Beckwith, fertilizer salesman there, was ultimately, after a long time, convicted of the murder. Medgar Evers spent a lot of time on the road in Mississippi rallying people to civil rights, a very effective spokesman, part of what got him so much attention. Here's a recording from March of the year he died, 1963, telling activists in Greenwood, Mississippi, they had to keep protesting, keep demonstrating. Here's Medgar Evers.
All we want you to do is keep going with this fight for freedom. And as we stick together here, as you feel the pains of dogs here in Greenwood, we'll feel them in Jackson. And if we feel them in Jackson, you feel them here. And when we get this unity, ladies and gentlemen, nothing can stop us. We're going to win this fight for freedom. Thank you very much.
His family knew that he was at risk. Here was his widow, Merle Evers Williams. She was a 30-year-old mother of three young children when he was killed. She was here with an interview with NPR's Debbie Elliott.
Medgar became number one on the Mississippi to kill list. And we never knew from one day to the next what would happen. I lived in fear of losing him. He lived being constantly aware that he could be killed at any time.
And here Meg Evers' daughter, Rena Evers Everett. She was just 8 years old that night when he was killed in the carport, the driveway outside the house, remembering here those moments after they heard the shot. It was a single shot. Here again from an interview with NPR's Debbie Elliott.
Daryl and I bolted, yelling for my mother, for the door. And then we stopped and ran down the steps and begged our father to get up.
He did not get up. Medgar Evers was dead 50 minutes later at the hospital. Michael Vincent Williams, how did he go from young man in Decatur, Mississippi, to this role so prominent in the NAACP in those years? What was the path?
Well, the path also started in terms of his determination to make changes. Like I say, that happened from a very young age. But he also went to the military in 1943, and when he comes back in 1946...
From Europe, World War II.
Mm-hmm. World War II. And when he comes back, he immediately tries to tackle voter discrimination. But it's this idea, this notion, that African-Americans had not been given that full citizenship rights, but then to go abroad and fight in defense of those kinds of liberties and then to come back and be denied those was something that really kind of stoked his already activist fire at that point. And so he comes back and he does that, but he also goes to Alcorn. And when he graduates Alcorn in 1952...
This is the historically black college in Mississippi.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And when he graduates in 52, and he goes to the Mississippi Delta, where he works for the Magnolia Mutual Life Insurance Company as an insurance salesman, he really begins to see the depth of the oppression that people are faced with. And this is something that he encounters day in and day out, the extreme poverty, the kind of control that is expressed against African-Americans at that point. And that goes back to what Dr. Lafayette said before. He kind of feels that kind of pain and oppression, and he does everything he possibly can to help, whether that's providing money when he had it or whether that was helping people escape. But these are the types of things that he sees on a constant basis, and it drives his activism. And in 1953, he makes the decision that he's going to actually try to break down the walls of segregation in education at the University of Mississippi Law School, which he filed his application in 1954. It doesn't happen, but he's later instrumental in helping James Meredith. But at that point, the NAACP was very much well aware of him because he had done a lot of volunteer work for the NAACP, offers him a job as field secretary, which he accepts in November 1954. And so that's when he really begins to kind of take off, because now he has an organization that already, you know, that was able to kind of back his activist bent at that point. And from 1954 to his assassination in 63, he works day and night to kind of address the issues of discrimination and oppression and violence and injustice in this state.
He was not admitted to the University of Mississippi Law School. Of course, James Meredith would ultimately go across that line. That military service always stayed with him. He would reference it often. Here, again, from 63, here's footage from NBC News Archive. This is after Jackson, Mississippi's Mayor Alan Thompson had agreed to desegregate some public facilities. Medgar Evers speaking with the press, saying he'd make sure that the mayor made good on that promise.
Now, for many of us who've gone overseas and fought for this country, we fought for Mississippi, we fought for Alabama, we fought for North Carolina, we fought for Illinois, and we fought for every state in this union. Now, we're going to stay here and see that the things that the mayor has said become a reality.
Bernard Lafayette, you're listening back to that. You were there at the time. Where did a man like Medgar Evers get that kind of courage? He knew the stakes. He knew his own life was at risk. But you hear the clarity of conviction in all of these comments from him. He is just laying it down. Where does that come from? What percentage of people have that kind of courage?
Well, I think it's very important, and it has not been said often enough, that many of those who served in the military went through training. They had courage to go and leave their homes and fight for this country abroad. What we have to understand is that military people were willing to give their lives, and many of them did.
Mm-hmm.
A large number of them gave their lives for this country. And it was not because they didn't like this country, but it was because they loved this country. And those of us who were in the civil rights movement, like Medgar Evers, okay, we loved this country, and we wanted to be the best for all of the people in this country. And that's where that courage and commitment came from. It was from our childhood, God bless America. And then we found ways to help to improve the country, to live out those promises. That's what Martin Luther King was all about. By the way, my position now is a distinguished senior scholar in residence at Emory University.
Mm-hmm.
I'm here doing the Summer Institute.
Yes.
And I have this title for University of Rhode Island. But the other thing I wanted to say was that Medgar Evers inspired a lot of the young people. And that was the thing that was so exciting. The SNCC people, they were young college students. But we saw examples in Medgar Evers and Martin Luther King and others like, you know, Ella Baker and Fannie Lou Hamer. They helped inspire us. Now, one thing that's little known is that the same night that Medgar was killed, I was attacked in front of my house in Selma, Alabama, where I was director of the Alabama Voter Registration Project, the very same night.
Mm-hmm.
And we learned later from the FBI that there was a three-state conspiracy. Ben Elton Cox, who worked with the Congress of Racial Equality in Louisiana, was also targeted. The FBI director from Mobile, Alabama, once he came and investigated my beating in Alabama, he told me this. And it's little known, even by historians, that same night, three people were supposed to have been killed. And as I say, I didn't know Medgar was killed until the next day, because I was in the hospital that same night. So the whole idea of assassination of leaders was a pattern that existed as well. But Medgar in and of himself was unique. Because, after all, he was in the heart of Mississippi. Mississippi had that reputation. You know, Michael will tell you that even on the Freedom Rides, you know, after we came through Alabama and we were beaten, it took a lot more courage to go through Mississippi. I can tell you that right now, okay?
Yes.
Because Mississippi, as Michael knows, he has that reputation of being the most, you know, violent and racist group. Mm. And, you know, I was in Parchman on the Freedom Rides as well. You know, I was the first group that went in.
Medgar Evers
was... Medgar was the one that provided the, like Jack Young, Attorney Jack Young.
Mm.
Medgar was the one that was working with him, NAACP lawyer, to help with the Freedom Rides and the Freedom Riders coming in.
Byron De La Beckwith was ultimately, much later, years later, convicted of the murder. Jerry Mitchells was a longtime reporter for the Jackson, Mississippi newspaper, the Clarion Ledger, and he interviewed the killer before his death in 2001. Here's Jerry Mitchell with NPR's Rachel Martin.
He's actually the most racist person I ever spent any time with. It's just one racial epithet or comment after another. He just kind of spewed it. And yet he was very kind to his wife, very gentlemanly. And so there's a kind of that massive Southern contradiction that we have, and all kind of wrapped up in him.
On May 20th, 1963, just a couple of weeks before his death, he won a big battle, was finally allowed to speak to the people of Jackson on the local TV station, WLBT. His 17-minute appearance on the station got all kinds of negative attention from white viewers. Here's his widow, Merle Evers Williams, reading part of the remarks from that night in an interview with CBS's Randall Pinkston.
Let me appeal to the consciousness of many silent, responsible citizens of the white community who know that a victory for democracy in Jackson will be a victory for democracy everywhere.
I want to welcome into our conversation right now from Washington, lifelong Mississippian, former governor of Mississippi, Haley Barbour, who was governor there from 2004 to 2012, former chairman of the Republican National Committee, graduate of the University of Mississippi and UMass School of Law. Governor Barbour, thank you very much for being with us.
Hey, thank you, Tom. I'm glad to be here. Actually, I'm in Mississippi this weekend. I'm at home.
Oh, great. It's great to have you with us from Mississippi. Take us back, if you can. You were younger than Medgar Evers, but you were old enough at that time to remember the culture and the setting. And take us back and describe from your perspective what he was up against in his work, Governor Barbour.
Well, of course, I was a high school kid. I was in the 10th grade when this was going on. But, you know, went to segregated schools and segregated programs and movies and all of that. You know, we were around black people in family situations and had great affection for them. However, you know, segregation was the way we grew up, and fortunately, as we got older, we learned that is wrong, is indefensible. But at the time, of course, it was just the way it was when you were growing up. In many ways, I feel like I couldn't have had a happier childhood. You know, my dad died when I was two, but my mother raised my two older brothers and me, and people loved us, were great to us, and lived in small town, and there are lots of great things about small town life. But when you look back, of course, the one glaring hole there is segregation.
And more than segregation, Medgar Evers spent a lot of time documenting harsh violence against people who tried to stand up for their rights.
Well, I grew up in a part of the state where you did not see much of that. If it were going on, it was not obvious. There were some parts of the state that there were really, really bad, violent things in Philadelphia and Meridian and Hattiesburg and some other places. Both before we were talking about and after, but Yazoo City, the small town where I grew up, but it was segregated. Don't get me wrong, but there was not violence here, and there was I think there were people in the community who were segregationists, but who also were very, very opposed to violence, and you know. Sometimes for selfish reasons, they thought it'd be bad for business. Sometimes because that was just too far.
Michael Vincent Williams, you're listening there from Mississippi State. What about the notion of Yazoo City as an island apart from the violence that too many knew in Mississippi at that time?
Well, I'd have to disagree with that. There's most documentation in terms of Yazoo City and the NAACP trying to get things changed there as well as other places as well. I think the issue that we see here is that Mississippi as a whole was a state that was devoted to denying African Americans their full citizenship rights. And it didn't matter what part of the state you were in, and that's what the battle was about. Now, you talked about courage a few minutes ago in terms of what does it take and how do you get that. What it was is that Medgar Evers had a complete and total dedication not only to fighting for rights for the here and now, but a commitment to the generations to come. And when you have that kind of outlook, and he had it and other activists had it as well, when you have that kind of outlook, then you tend to put aside the kind of dangers you're going to face and you go all out. And that's what Medgar Evers had. The problem that we see in the 1960s, 1961, 62, 63, that he was involved with was changing the state, the entire state. He also had a complete commitment to Mississippi because he saw it as not only the state of his birth, but his home. And he often said, when you're on your home have a problem, you don't abandon it for another one. You fix it so that it then becomes a symbol of the very best you have to offer instead of a symbol of the worst. And so the fact that Yazoo or Greenwood or Jackson or Biloxi, in terms of their degrees of violence, the issue was the fact that they were still dedicated to segregation and dedicated to holding the status quo. And that's something that Medgar Evers was determined to bust up.
I'm so glad to have all three of you with us. Haley Barbour, former Mississippi Governor Haley Barbour, please stand by there. Michael Vincent Williams, author of the biography Medgar Evers, Mississippi Martyr, please stand by. And Reverend Dr. Bernard Lafayette Jr., out of Emory, joining us today from University of Rhode Island. It's Bob Dylan, Only a Pawn in Their Game, performed live at Newport, Rhode Island Folk Festival in 63, inspired by the death of Medgar Evers. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
The South politician preaches to the poor white man. You got more than the blacks, don't complain. You're better than them. You've been born with white skin, they explain. And the Negro's name is used, it is plain, for the politician's gain as he rises to fame. And the poor white remains on the caboose of the train, so it ain't him to blame. He's only a pawn in their game.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about slain civil rights hero Medgar Evers, 50 years after his assassination in Mississippi, looking at his history, his legacy. In January this year, 2013, at President Obama's second inauguration, his widow, Merle Evers Williams, civil rights activist in her own right, delivered the invocation.
That the vision of those who came before us and dreamed of this day, that we recognize that their visions still inspire us. They are a great cloud of witnesses, unseen by the naked eye, but all around us, thankful that their living was not in vain.
And just this last week, Wednesday, at a memorial at Medgar Evers' gravesite in Arlington National Cemetery commemorating the 50th anniversary of his assassination, June 12, 1963, again his widow, Merle Evers Williams, shared what she said her husband might say if he were there.
I can hear Medgar's voice saying, "I thank all of you for believing in me, but it's really not necessary. Just get out there and prove that you believe in me and that you believe in my country, which is our country."
Michael Vincent William joins us today from Mississippi State University, author of the biography Medgar Evers, Mississippi Martyr. Reverend Dr. Bernard Lafayette Jr. joins us out of Emory, joins us today from Kingston, Rhode Island and the University of Rhode Island. And former Mississippi Governor Haley Barbour joins us from Yazoo City, Mississippi. Haley Barbour, we heard Evers Williams reading there earlier from the speech that Medgar Evers made, that extraordinary speech on WLBT in Jackson, very rare opportunity to speak there, where he said, you know, he said, "Let me appeal to the consciences of many silent, responsible citizens of the white community who know that a victory for democracy in Jackson will be a victory for democracy everywhere." Was that constituency really out there to hear him, Haley Barbour? Was there that sympathetic white community in 1963?
Well, of course, I was a high school kid, but there's no question that there was. There were people who were, there were people who were segregationists who were terribly against violence. But there were people by then who had come to realize that segregation was just wrong. That it not only was morally wrong that one group of people should be held down, but it was bad for the state. You were beginning to have some politicians in the 63 election and the 67 election who were starting to say this. They didn't succeed, really, until Bill Waller in 1971 was kind of a transitional governor. And all these people were Democrats except for one, Rubel Phillips in 1967. 4 years after what we're talking about, mm-hmm. The Republican candidate for governor said about integration of the schools that we cannot hold down half the people in the state and the rest of the state prosper, and therefore that we have got to, he was talking about improving the schools for black kids. He wasn't talking about integration at that time, but that's where people were starting to understand that what had been not only prominent, dominant in the past, just wasn't gonna cut it anymore. And the biggest reason is it was wrong. I had the when I was governor, it was the 50th anniversary of the Freedom Riders, And so we had an event for the Freedom Riders at the governor's mansion. One of your guests was talking about when he came with the Freedom Riders in 1961. He got taken to the state penitentiary, to Parchman. And it was interesting, Doctor. We had about 175 former Freedom Riders who came at some point during that week of activity. And the place that they most wanted to go visit was Parchman, the state penitentiary. Oh. But they sure hadn't been invited to the governor's mansion in 1961. And I hope that was very symbolic of what's changed, not only in Mississippi, but across the South and other places in the country as well, that while this is a system we grew up with, it's a system's indefensible. And there were starting to be people, or there were people who were starting to be willing to talk about this. Politically, it was still several years before any politicians had guts enough to talk about it, but Medgar Evers was right. He's right about a lot of things. He's right about that, too.
Michael Vincent Williams, remind us of his murderer, Byron De La Beckwith, and what he represented in Mississippi society of that time.
Well, at that point, Beckwith represented this kind of complete and total devotion toward white supremacy. As a member of the White Citizens Council and other groups, that's what he represented. That's what he believed wholeheartedly. that African Americans were indeed inferior and that the white race was a superior race. And so that's kind of the ideal that he had. That was the very thing that Evers and others were battling against. And going along with, in terms of what the governor said earlier, in terms of there were people who were beginning to see segregation as wrong, I agree with that. But I don't think that we can forget the reason they began to see those types of things, not because they come upon that on their own, but because of the mass amount of black protest that was going on and the economic boycotts that was happening, the amount of people who were coming from other parts of this nation, SNCC core. And Evers was organizing a great deal of this, 1961, 62, and 63, and putting a great deal of pressure upon Mississippi officials and businessmen to kind of reevaluate how they saw their positions and their place. And so we cannot forget the significance of that. But in terms of Byron Della Beckwith, that's what Evers was battling against day in and day out, is that kind of staunch devotion to segregation and white supremacy in the state.
And remind us why it took until 1994 for him ultimately to be convicted?
Well, he went through two trials in 1964 that ended up in hung juries. And so since it wasn't a all-out acquittal, the possibility always could be that he'd be retried. What happened in 1989 is that Jerry Mitchell began to investigate the Mississippi State Sovereignty Commission involvement in those cases in terms of juries and things of that nature, and that kind of opened the door up for the murder investigation to start all over again, which is eventually what happened, and leading to Beckwith's third trial, which he'd be convicted in February 1994.
He died in prison in 2001. Wardell is calling from Lexington, Kentucky. Wardell, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Thank you. Thank you. And good. Enjoy the conversation, by the way.
Thank you.
I just wanted to add just a couple of things. During my childhood, I think I was around 13 years old when many of these things were going on.
Mm-hmm.
I'm now a college professor at Eastern Kentucky University, and I do share a lot of these experiences with my students. And one of the things that I always tell them is that these things were going on in my hometown. I lived this, so I can share many of these life experiences with them.
Where did you grow up, Wardell, and were you growing up white or black?
I am black, and mm-hmm. I grew up in Greenwood, Mississippi.
Mm-hmm.
And it was during that era when Stokely Carmichael and Martin Luther King and all of these different groups were coming to Greenwood to have mass meetings and things of that nature. And I had an uncle who was a minister there. His name was Reverend Aaron Johnson.
Mm-hmm.
And my uncle used to open up his church for Martin Luther King and some of the other groups to come in and have mass meetings. And he was one of the first ministers to have the nerve to open up his church to allow King to come in and they would have a place to meet. And I remember as a young boy, I used to take, we lived directly behind the church, and I used to take food and coffee over there that my mother had made for the groups that were there meeting. And I remember distinctly the mass meetings and all the conversations and the strategy sessions. And this was a very, very well thought out, very, very methodical operation that was going on with King and SNCC and the Corps and all these groups. It was very, very, very planned and thought out.
Were you old enough to understand when Medgar Evers was killed and see people's reaction to that?
I was old enough, I think I was 13 or 14 years old, but my uncle was so involved in the movement that I got a lot of the information from him and a lot of the tears and all the things that to let us know that something really, really serious had happened. But being 13, you really don't know the impact it's having on your life or community, but you know it was something that was very, very serious.
Looking back today, there's so much courage demonstrated here. It seems like almost superhuman courage, given that he knew the threats that were out there.
Right. And when you look back at those years, even when I was in college and working on my PhD and all those kinds of things, that is where you draw that energy from. When people are trying to keep you from doing something that you know you want to do, you draw back from those life experiences and you move forward with it.
Wardell, I'm very grateful for your call today. As somebody who grew up in that neck of the woods in that time, grew up black in that circumstance, let me get another caller right here, Laura in Boston. Laura, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I had a very different experience growing up in white in Mississippi than the governor is reporting. I grew up mostly in very small towns, and I remember vividly the night that Negro Evers was shot, the terror in my mother's voice, and she, you know, saying out loud, "They've shot Medgar Evers." And you know, I just wanted to kind of say that there wasn't this kind of monolithic experience of white people growing up in Mississippi at the time. That it
sure.
was, you know, for people who were in these really, really isolated small towns. We were living in a town of 600 people. That the, you know, the pressure that was put on us to conform to, you know, the accepted view, which was, you know, it wasn't just, you know, segregation is bad. It was really, you know, violent racism. The pressure put on us was just incredible. And, you know, I think that's it's a view that's not, hasn't been represented.
And that is the
today.
Pressure put on white Mississippians to get in line with that attitude.
Well, yeah, you know, people who, you know, my father was a minister too, and he was teaching in a junior college, and you know, really doing what he felt he could do to support the movement, and yeah, the pressure on my family was just terrific. I mean, it was, you know, we weren't ever, I suppose, physically in danger, although we were threatened constantly. I had a guy waving a machete over his head at me when I was in second grade. So, you know, the descriptions of, I think people do not understand what it was like in Mississippi at the time. And if it was happening to, you know, this affluent white family, I mean, it's hard to even imagine for me, you know, who was there for what it must have been like for people who were really active in the movement and people who were black and facing, you know, this kind of crazy time there.
And we know what it was like ultimately for Medgar Evers, sadly. One more call, and I want to get back to my guests. Jeff in Oklahoma City. Oklahoma, thank you for calling, Jeff. You're on.
Hey, Tom. I just wanted to make a quick question here. Obviously, there's not a lot of legal segregation these days, but I wanted to get your guest comments on the segregation that still exists as far as socioeconomic disparity and, like, incarceration rates. The, you know, blacks are only 10% of the population but continue to be incarcerated at five times the rate of white people. So I'm just curious what they had to say, even though there's no legal segregation anymore. What about the social segregation that continues to this day?
Dr. Bernard Lafayette, may I bring that to you? What do you say to Jeff's observation?
Yes, we do see that, and in fact, we have actually retrogressed, because back in the late 70s and 80s, you had more blacks in PhD programs, and now that is quickly diminishing, at least the African-American blacks. So I'm looking at the increase in the incarceration rate, as you mentioned, okay?
Mm-hmm.
That's worse than it was earlier. So we have to say that there is a systematic plan to incarcerate blacks, not just simply to affect their economics, but also the political, because so goes the political, okay? So goes the economic conditions, because the people who are involved in making those decisions from political point of view are those who decide how the resources are going to be used in our government, our tax money. That's what they be voting on. They don't be voting on policies relating to what color a building should be.
Mm.
They are talking about economics. They're voting on our tax money. And we are required by law to pay taxes. So it's not voluntary. Okay?
Yep.
So what happened is that we have actually taken some steps backwards. And I think the main reason is because we are unconscious of the thing that seems so subtle. Now, the signs have been removed, okay?
Mm-hmm.
But the symptoms are still there. So if there are symptoms, that means that there's a deep-rooted problem. And my own opinion about this is that we're looking at what we call the third-generation syndrome. And a lot of the people are not aware of that. And that's why you hear people talk about getting blacks back in control and getting blacks, you know, in their place, is because they're looking at what happened when their grandparents were in charge, okay? And a lot of the whites feel that they have lost what their grandfathers used to have, that is control over other people.
Watch out as the future of our demographics come down the pike on that score. Medgar Evers died for civil rights, but that effort, I guess, never ends. Takes different forms. Reverend Dr. Bernard Lafayette, Jr., I want to thank you very much for being with us today. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Governor Haley Barbour, governor of Mississippi from 2004 to 2012. Thank you so much, Governor Barbour, for being here.
Sure.
And Michael Vincent Williams at Mississippi State University, author of Medgar Evers, Mississippi Martyr. Thank you for joining us, Michael.
Thank you so much,
Professor Williams. Thank you. Thanks to you all. We'll go out with the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee Freedom Singers, led by Matthew Jones, performing Ballad of Medgar Evers. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
He taught words of love, dignity, and freedom. He died before he'd be a slave. Then a high-powered rifle tore out his heart and laid